Hey there, it's Gary Parrish, and this is the Eye on College Basketball Podcast. I've got Matt Norlander with me. I've got Sam Bassini with me. It's Thursday night. It's March 3rd in the year 2016. Arizona just beat California, so let me rephrase. It is late Thursday night, almost Friday, and I'll tell you, if Jaylen Brown wasn't ahead of James Thompson, the fourth, on Norlander's freshman rankings earlier this week, he's not going to be ahead of him next time that's updated. Jaylen Brown tonight, 2 of 9 from the field, 5 points, 5 fouls. Norlander, I know you must have felt vindicated on some level watching Jaylen Brown struggle on a national stage.
No, I did. It was vindication, yes.
It is James Thompson the fourth, right?
Yes, it is. JT the four. Come on now.
JT four. I thought so. I just want to make sure.
There we go. We had talked about that. We talked about that as we wrapped up Wednesday's podcast, and it was well timed on my behalf. Listen, I love Jaylen Brown's game. I think he's a good college player. I think he'll be a really nice pro, but he didn't show up. And in Cal overall, listen, Cal had the game essentially wrapped up. I think a lot of people were ready to crown him. It would have been a huge win for Cal's resume because it's been able to get road wins over the past couple of weeks. But winning at Arizona is just a different deal altogether. And for Zona to go on an 11-0 run to end the game and get the win, it also means something for that team in the Pac-12 in regard to the league tournament, because there's bye situations and, you know, you really want to play as few games as possible in a league tournament situation, generally speaking. And good for the league overall, because I think this will actually end up, because I think Cal's and Zona, they're going to be about in the same spot in terms of seeding, I would think. So Arizona needed that for its resume, not to just slip into a tricky spot. Like, I think Zona now, if you play out the odds, I think it'll be a 6 at worst. But they needed that win over Cal, and they just barely got it in the end.
And then there was a terrific moment on Twitter afterward. Archie Miller tweeting, "Storm the court." Did you see that?
I did not. Beautiful. That's awesome.
Archie, of course, Sean Miller's brother. Uh-huh. Sean, of course, the coach of the Arizona Wildcats, who recently went on a I don't want to say a tirade. It wasn't a tirade, but it sort of explained why court storming has to stop in the Pac-12 or else somebody's going to get hurt. More specifically, he said one of his players is going to punch a fan someday. and so there was Archie with the hashtag storm the court right after Arizona.
Strong.
Arizona beat Cal. You know what? You said you thought people were getting ready to crown Cal, and I get that because Cal had been super hot and people are falling in love with their roster, particularly their freshmen. And Ivan Rabb was really good tonight. I think he got like 15 and 13. But I noticed even like Deadspin, you know, had something up on Cal tonight.
I saw that.
Right.
How about that?
So that's my point. Like, people are really you know what? I don't think any less of Cal at this moment than I thought of Cal 4 hours ago. Like, you know what? They lost at the McKell Center. Like, so what? Who, like, most teams? It's a little, like, I think sometimes we watch teams lose on the road and we go, well, okay, like, what do we think? And I'm like, who wouldn't lose? Who wouldn't have lost at the McKell Center tonight?
Oregon.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Oregon. but basically I mean that, like, other top 20 teams. Like, I'd say of the top 20 teams, 15 of them would have probably lost at the McKell Center tonight.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
That's just college
in
basketball.
In a lot of ways, yeah. I don't think any less of Cal, but I certainly don't think any more of them either at this point. I mean, this is still a team that is now, I think, 3-9 or something, 3-8 or so, away from Hoss Pavilion. They just cannot beat good teams away from that building right now. And that's kind of a problem going forward, considering they're not going to play any NCAA tournament games at Hoss Pavilion. Their only wins on the road, so to speak, are against Washington and Washington State. Mm-hmm. That was a 3-point win against Washington. Obviously, they blew out Washington State. And then an overtime win against Wyoming. They have lost in neutral floor or road settings now to San Diego State, Richmond, Virginia, Oregon, Oregon State, Stanford, Utah, Colorado, and Arizona. I understand that they look a lot better right now than they did early in the season. But I do wonder if part of this is they got to play 5 of those 7 games during that 7-game win streak at home, where they are very comfortable and play their best basketball. This game against Arizona State over the weekend, I think, is going to be pretty interesting, because Arizona State, that's not an easy place to play necessarily. And this Arizona State team is a really tough physical team that is going to take you out of your comfort zone at the very least. If they can go on the road, win that game, and then perform well in the Pac-12 tournament, I'll feel a lot better about them being the kind of five or six seed that I think that, or five or six seed that can make a run even, that some people are talking them up as, because right now it just seems like a team that can kind of be stopped on the road easily.
I guess I would say this. Obviously, in the NCAA tournament, you don't have to play road games, right? That goes without saying. Beyond that,
you also don't get to play home games, though.
I agree, but their neutral court losses were, by definition, early in the season, and it took a little while for Jalen and Ivan to get going. Our research department at CBS Sports Network, my buddy Andy Tulin had a stat, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but like
it's very helpful.
I know. Okay. So I'm about to
tell you a stat out here, and I don't know what it is. Let's just roll with it.
I'm about to tell you a statistic that's going to blow your mind, although I can't actually remember what it is. But the point you'll be able to accept, even if I don't have the exact number right. The number of teams who have a winning record in true road games this year in all of college basketball, I believe it's like single digits.
Yeah, I would believe that without a doubt.
I don't doubt that. By the way,
I might have made that up. It's something
I can look up really quickly.
It might be 9 teams or 9%. It's the camp
in true road games.
True road games. Nobody wins on the road. That's the point. That's the point I'm trying to make. Nobody wins on the road consistently. Nobody consistently wins on the road.
Yeah, no, it's fair. No, there's something to that. I think
it might be high major schools, because I'm looking at a lot of schools here that
if you get like, you know, Stephen F. Austin's romping.
Hey, in fairness, I told you I couldn't remember it.
So anyway, ignore that altogether. My hypothesis is that no matter what Cal does, I think it's going to be a very trendy Sweet 16 pick, no matter what its seed is, just by nature of the guys it has and the way it plays. And, you know, we'll see. But, Sam, you're right on the money just in terms of the ASU game this weekend. I think that is an important one just in terms of maybe that team getting a little bit right.
All right. Let's move off of Cal, Arizona. And I got a whole bunch of stuff I want to talk about. But before we start talking about things that are actually happening in this season and this weekend, let's rewind 10 years, because you had a really well-done piece on George Mason that posted earlier Thursday at CBSSports.com. For anybody who hasn't read it yet, you absolutely should, because I'll be honest, sometimes these stories bore me. Like the idea of them, like, okay, I know what happened. I don't need to relive it. And yet one of the things you were able to do, and I told you this privately, I'll say it publicly, you were able to tell me things about that I didn't remember or know. Probably both, right? And I thought it was really good in that respect. If you're going to retell me a story, tell me some stuff I didn't know. And this had several examples of that. And so it's a great trip down memory lane and is a wonderful reminder of just how improbable that whole deal was. So I'll ask you this, Norlander.
Okay.
What was by the way, you can say thank you for all that stuff I said about it.
I said thank you publicly or privately, and I'm going to say thank you publicly.
Here's what I would say. Here's what I'm asking you. What was the one thing that stood out to you that you went, oh, wow, I had no idea? Like, as you're reporting this story, I think you spoke to more than 20 people involved, including a lot of players, Jim Larrañaga, of course, his staff, but also Jim Calhoun, Tom Izzo, Mark Turgeon, so on and so forth. What's the one nugget where you went, oh, wow, that's unbelievable. I bet most people don't know that.
Okay. I'm going to cheat and say two.
Okay.
One was three or four Mason players basically told me that the UConn team had serious chemistry issues. It was very evident in that second half. And Lamar Butler said on the record, he said, Rudy Gay came off. He explained the play to me, what happened on the play. He said he couldn't remember when it happened, but I had to obviously like fact check this and make sure you could see it on the tape. And he said, Gay hits a shot off a curl. After that, he pounds his chest and pardon the swear here, but he said, pass me the fucking ball to Marcus Williams. And after that, the Mason players told me that the dynamic on the floor for UConn, while they still were able to tie the game, I think a lot of people forget that Mason, like, Mason really blew it in the end to get it to overtime, and UConn, you know, miraculously got it there. Even in spite of that, he said there was just, you could tell there was something off. I wasn't aware that there was that much of a fracture. And then it didn't make the story, but a couple of Mason players had said that they had seen, like Rashad Anderson, Denham Brown, Josh Boone later after the game, not that day, that week, but like down the road. And they had talked about it and they said, yeah, there was just, our team wasn't that right that year. There was a locker room issues. So I was unaware of that and that stood out. But the other thing,
I would say to that point, one of the things that I found interesting was, how the guys told you that Larrañaga had basically would not allow them to wear headphones while they were around each other or around or just in public in general. He wanted them interacting with each other, talking with each other, talking to other people. And it's one of the things they noticed about UConn very quickly. Like when UConn got off the bus, they were all wearing headphones. They weren't talking to each other. They weren't hanging out, and we were having the best time ever. And again, this, none of this stuff really means anything if UConn wins and George Mason loses. But sure. I thought it was just interesting that the Mason players noticed something different about them as it related to themselves.
Yes, and listen, I had a few, like, I had to cut a lot from this story, but there are a few things that just...
You could not have possibly cut a lot from that story.
Trust me.
I felt like I was reading forever.
Like, in terms of the pace and the tension, like, there were... So, I'm going to post on my own personal website just a few other things that didn't make it, because there are other elements to, I think, the UConn game and the players, but you're right about the headphone thing. And they talked about how it meant so much. Like, they didn't necessarily like that at first, but then once they got to the Sweet 16 and the Final Four, like, everyone at campus knew all of them, and it was a big-time thing. Like, Larrañaga was like, don't walk around campus with your headphones on. Be ambassadors to this university. And it was all this stuff that he had said, not in February, but, like, way before. Long-winded answer to get to the second part, GP, though. The other thing was, I did not realize the circumstances surrounding the Wichita State game that was the Bracket Busters game. Mm-hmm. Two quick things. One, Larrañaga told me, and this wasn't in the story, Larrañaga told me that someone that he knew at ESPN came to him and asked him who he wanted to play, and he said, give me the toughest team. He knew it was going to be a road game. He said, give me the toughest team in the Valley that you can possibly get me, because I need to have that win. Like, he really understood that they needed a big non-conference win. Turgeon told me that he didn't had no idea that that had happened. No one ever asked him about that, so I thought that was interesting. But Tony Skin almost didn't play in the game.
I thought that was good. I didn't know that.
Not only this, and like, I didn't really emphasize in the story, but so Skin almost doesn't play in the game because he gets into this fight with Bashir Mason, who's now the coach at Wagner. Okay. Earlier, like, Bashir Mason and Skin were both recruited by Larrañaga to go to Mason, and Skin goes on a visit. And Larrañaga had this thing where he did to Lamar Butler too. He goes, listen, I only got room for one spot. And he wasn't lying to him. It was just a tactic he used. He said, I only got one spot. And if you want that scholarship, you're going to have to commit to me, or you chance losing it to another player. So Skin commits the day after Bashir Mason then goes, takes and visit, and he doesn't get to go to George Mason because Skin beat him. And it's those two players that get into a tussle when Bashir Mason's at Drexel, and he almost didn't play in the Wichita State game. So there's that. There's the fact that one of the, you know, Follerin Campbell, who was the point guard, lost his grandmother and like really was dead set on going to Africa. And I really had to chop a lot of that down, but it was like a thing for like 4 or 5 days. Like, Larrañaga said he can go, but he was not comfortable with it whatsoever. There was a huge meeting at Follerin's parents' house. So there were a lot of factors that were going against Mason even having its full roster available at Wichita State, which is already a tough place to play. And then Skin is the one that actually hits the winning shot for the three-pointer at Wichita State. And then it's that play, that design play, that Wichita State goes back to in the UConn game and runs legitimately
over and over again
25 times in a row because Jim Calhoun refuses to double because they had the best front court. They led the nation in blocks. He doubled him once, and I think it was Butler hit him, killed him with a three, and so Calhoun said, we're not doubling ever again. And so that's why Mason just was able to stay and stay and stay in the game. So anyway, it was truly just like, So fun to write. A personal anecdote, I watched that game with my brothers, and it was before I covered college basketball nationally, and it's the last time that I actually like was legitimately, I would say I was like into the Davidson thing and rooting for Davidson, but I was like emotionally invested in George Mason beating UConn in that game and getting to the Final Four just because I wanted to see it. I was so pessimistic. I didn't think there was any chance. As I kind of tweeted when I teased the article, like, I'm still waiting for Denham Brown's three to go in because you know, the one seed does not lose in that spot. Like, it just almost never happens. So it was just it was amazing, really fun thing to write. I wanted to ask you guys, Gary, I guess you would have been at the commercial appeal at that time, and Sam, you were probably seven. But do you remember? Do you remember where you were? Because to me, the Mason over UConn one, it's like, remember where you were. Like, I remember when Farouk Manesh beat Kansas with the shot. I just wondered if you guys did have that with Mason, and you knew where you were watching when.
I wasn't watching. I was on a plane.
Oh, brutal.
Missed the whole thing. You know why? Because the day prior, I was in Oakland for the Adam Morrison crying game. The Adam Morrison crying game was a few days before, but that was on a Thursday.
You're right. Because that was the Sweet 16 against UCLA.
The Saturday, it was Memphis-UCLA. In Oakland, 1-2 seeds in the West Regional. And John Calipari, I was the Memphis beat writer, was so pissed off because they had beaten UCLA by they were up a billion. They won by double digits, I believe, at the Garden back in November, right around Thanksgiving, one of those events. I only remember because my 13-year-old, my little boy who just turned 13, he was, I guess, 3 at the time. And we
you
went.
You think so?
Yeah, I'm doing the math on it in my head. And so I took him and Kelly both to New York with me for the NIT, whatever it was called. And we ended up going. Like, somebody invited me. Like, hey, why don't you go to we're having a Thanksgiving dinner with all the teams. My point is, we had Thanksgiving dinner with Jordan Farmar. it was me, Kelly, Jordan Farmar, and my little boy Aiden. That was our Thanksgiving dinner. So fast forward all the way to the regional, and Cal's pissed off because they're the one seed, Memphis is, and this is Darius Washington, Sean Williams, I think Joey Dorsey was a freshman, Chris Douglas Roberts, Antonio Anderson, they were freshmen, and they're playing a road game, 18,000 UCLA fans. The one seed's in a road game, and they missed like their first 18 three-pointers. They played terribly, and they end up losing. And so to wrap this back around to the Final Four Mason was in, because Mason won, and I don't know if people remember, Florida was not a one seed. And there were no one seeds there.
It was the first time that in the modern era that all four one seeds failed to reach the Final Four.
Right. So it was George Mason, LSU, UCLA, and Florida. And this is – so the next weekend – Rodney Carney was on this team too, this Memphis team. So the Final Four weekend, Calipari is at the – Rodney Carney's in the slam dunk competition, like at the Final Four. And I end up sitting with him because Rodney Carney's there. So I'm there as the beat writer, and he's there. So I end up sitting with him. And we're just chit-chatting, and he sort of – I'll never forget this moment. And since you already said a bad word, I'll say a bad word too, and we can bleep him if we have to. But he said, Cal looks at me and he goes, you know what's still driving me crazy? And I said, what? He said, if we'd have just played shitty, we would have won. But we didn't even play shitty. We didn't even play that well. And they would have been the only one seed at the Final Four. And if you go by seeds, they would have probably, that Memphis team, been the favorite to win a national championship.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, right. So anyway, the next day I'm flying home from Oakland to Memphis. I missed it. I never saw the game live. I've seen the highlights, obviously, a million times. I did not see the game.
Sam, just real quick, the one amazing one that I didn't see was Arizona-Illinois. I did not see that game. I was, don't want to get too crazy and deep into it, but I was actually going through a breakup.
So you were listening to Bright Eyes instead.
Yeah, no, it was I legitimately as the game was happening, I was going through a breakup. Like, oh, wow. It was actually happening. A dumping was going on. So I never saw Arizona Illinois, which is, one of the greatest comebacks ever. And that was the year before. Sam, do you remember the Mason game at all? Where are you from?
Vaguely. I definitely remember watching it.
Sam was in his high chair.
He had
dropped his pacifier. I was
15 years old, still in a high chair. Can confirm that. Okay. I remember it vaguely. I don't remember it in detail by any means. Like, you can pull out details. Even the Farouk Manesh shot. I was in college for that, and I don't even remember it. Like, I remember the shot. I remember that a lot more in detail than I remember this Denim Brown shot, for instance, where you just assumed it was going to go in. Some thoughts generally. I mean, mine are just so much more on the surface. When I was reading it, I kept confusing Tony Skin for Jamie Skeen on that VCU team.
Okay.
Like trying to like figure out like, wait a minute, why do they keep referring to this guy as Tony? Isn't his name Jamie? Like it was just like in my brain because like these ups like I kind of conflated the
Shout
two.
Shout out to Devin Downey.
Yeah, exactly. Shout out to Devin Downey. I kind of conflated the two in my brain at that point for some reason. I don't know why. Number two, you guys pointed out the headphones thing. That was one of the things that stood out to me most just because it's something you can see in his Miami teams now. I mean, there have already been videos posted by Miami's social media people of like this Miami team just having a blast together in the locker room, dancing. You know, they've wrapped Ritz-Carlton in a video. Like this group at Miami looks pretty similar to what you described in the Mason piece, right? So it was interesting to kind of compare the two. And then the last thing that I noticed, and this is definitely the most important thing, is I had totally forgotten about the song Kryptonite by Purple Ribbon All-Stars.
Right.
And I listened to it like 8 times today.
It's
now like on my playlist, like for eternity, probably.
Real quick, I'll wrap this up, then we can hit the games upcoming. So Larinaga had just listened. This was not a new thing for that tournament. He just has a way of having a corny, goofy, but inspirational pregame speeches. And I don't even think the Kryptonite thing is a great motivator, but it has stuck with the team forever. He said, you know, UNC, their fans see him as Superman. Your uniforms are green. That's Kryptonite. And then he plays the song and starts dancing. And just the idea of Jim Larinaga at 56 getting down to Big Boy and Killer Mike is just too good. I want to emphasize.
I didn't like just, that one, the Kryptonite thing. I'm like, whatever. The CAA was really good, though, I thought.
CAA was great because you know what was funny is I think it was Jai Lewis that really set it up for me where he was like, yeah, coach sat us down, play Kryptonite. And he goes, they don't, because UConn was, they weren't killing them before. And I didn't remember this at all. But they were just basically like, they thought they were in the Patriot League because their nickname's the Patriots. They didn't know anyone on the team. I love the fact that Will Thomas, the no-name big man for George Mason, absolutely dominated Rudy Gay in like a really tough Baltimore High School League, has never lost to Rudy Gay. Thought that was so awesome that they ended up meeting in the tournament. Will Thomas won again. He's 8-0 lifetime versus Rudy Gay. And but Jai Lewis said, yeah, he's trying to get us up. They don't even know who you are. They don't even know what league you're in. You guys are in the CAA. And the way Jai Lewis explained it was like, and we were just like, there was like some dead air. And we were like, yeah, coach. He's like, no, you were in the CAA. You were in the Connecticut Assassin Association. And then the entire locker room like starts going nuts. They're playing Kryptonite again. Like, it's just like this amazing thing. But I do want to say from like a behind the scenes reporting perspective, Larinaga was probably on the phone with me. I talked to him 3 times for about 3 hours total. And this is a coach in the middle of a season where he's trying to get a 1 seed, trying to get an ACC regular season championship. I didn't expect that much time. At one day I called him literally, he was like, let's talk at 7:20 in the morning, which I'm never up that early, but I called him at 7:20. He picked right up when we talked, and we went for 40 minutes, just kind of picked up from where we went from the previous interview. I talked to people in the Philippines, Poland, Spain, all across. Everyone was really accommodating for the story.
Calhoun seemed I thought his quotes were interesting. Like Calhoun seemed good.
Calhoun was my last interview. I did try and get Roy Williams, and I did not get him. I did not think I'd get Calhoun. I got him. He was on the phone with me for about 30 minutes, and he was amazing.
I thought so. It came across that way.
Flat out amazing. Gave me more than I could even. And for you know how Calhoun talks. I mean, it's like he is rolling, and I'm just like trying to type to keep up with him, and I'm taping it. And the transcribing session after that was just like, what am I even doing here? Yeah. But he was very, very good. I'll leave it on this. The Mason, to me, the thing is like with Butler and VCU and Wichita State, it's not that they just came after that, but those programs had more money into them. They had much more college basketball history. Mason had never won a tournament game. They barely got into the field. No one really even knew who George Mason was. It was a college with one of those weird nicknames like Oral Roberts. Okay, now it's like Mason's on a radar. But 10 years ago, it just was not. It was a complete unknown. And what it did, I mean, it just changed the dynamic, man. I mean, there had never been a school at that level that had ever gotten to a Final Four. And since then, we've seen many instances of that. And I just felt it was appropriate to go back down that road. And And now we spent like 10, 15 minutes talking about something that happened 10 years ago. But no, it's so impactful. I love that story.
I enjoy it. No, I like this conversation. I like. I hope people like it as much as I do.
I also want to point something out, too. Like, Mason is not in the A-10, like in like a, you know, high mid-major conference if this doesn't happen either. Like, it's had genuine impact on the school, like just from the standpoint of, you know, improving that basketball program's livelihood. And I think that that's worth pointing out, too. Not in all of the cool facts that you pointed out about the university as well after about how their enrollment went way higher. How much was the dollar figure? Was it like $670 million of marketing?
Oh, yeah. Is that what it was? Yeah. They forwarded me a PowerPoint. Like, it was like 40 pages. But yeah, with print and TV and radio, whatever, it was in terms of free advertising for that, like 4 week period alone was insane.
Hi, Carter.
Yeah, my son is here. I just fed him a bottle and he's now done. And anyway,
two other things that I thought were interesting. One, and I didn't know this, George Mason never sold out a game that year.
Yeah.
That was interesting. Like, it became this big deal.
Not even
deal.
Close to selling out a game. Yeah.
It became this big deal, but it was not a big deal throughout the season. They never sold out a game all season. And then the other thing that a bunch of people pointed out to you is that they were outside of, and at the time, like, Lunardi was the bracket, right? Joe Lunardi at ESPN, he was the bracket, and he had them out the entire time. And then, like, 5 minutes before the selection show starts, he puts George Mason in, which is which is curious, if for no other reason than, the data had not changed.
Let me real quick, because you know what? I almost didn't put that in, but the fact of the matter is every coach told me, and then two other players remembered it happening this way as well. Right. And it's important to the frame of the story because when Mason lost in the CAA to Hofstra, it had to wait a week until Selection Sunday. So for about 6 days, it was nothing but uncertainty and some pessimism. And then about 5-10 minutes before the selection show is going to start, Chris Caputo, who's an assistant now at Miami under Larry Nagant, was there at Mason. He gets a call from his girlfriend and from Dan Steinberg from the Washington Post saying, you guys are now in Lunardi's bracket. Like, so they go 6 days thinking they're out. And at the 11th hour and the 59th minute, it all changes. So it was important to the structure of the story because then when the selection show started, the mood of the room at Larinaga's house, it was very different. There was still some uncertainty because they weren't sure. But at that time, Lunardi, I mean, a decade, like, he's still relevant now and doing his stuff. But, like, especially before – that was, like, really before bracketology just became, like, everywhere. He was really the only, like, major, major super one at that point. And so it was a big-time thing for them. Everyone kind of breathed a little – before their name actually popped up on the screen.
Let's transition straight from this into Jim Larinaga's current team, which is the Miami Hurricanes, of course, because they are at this moment tied with North Carolina atop the ACC standings. They both got one game left. Miami is at Virginia Tech on Saturday afternoon, and then North Carolina is at Duke on Saturday night. And obviously, they're two 40-minute basketball games. The point spreads won't be much on either one of them. But this is true, I believe. I know this is true. Miami will be favored at Virginia Tech. And I believe Duke will be favored over North Carolina. So if the games go the way that odds makers say they're supposed to go, Larinaga is about to win an outright ACC title. And it'll be his second title in the past 4 years at Miami. And Miami, in the history of its men's basketball program, before Larinaga got there, had only won one league title ever. Leonard Hamilton won a Big East title once upon a time. But
are we going to put Jim Larinaga's statue up at Miami with him in a ladder?
Well, see, that's the thing that I think gets lost about the Tom Crean statue is that we don't want to do it simply because it needs to be done. We want to do it because...
It does, though.
Listen.
It does need to be done.
Let me be clear if I'm not being clear. It absolutely needs to be done, all right? But that's not the primary motivation. We also want the Tom Crean statue of him standing on a ladder holding a pair of scissors because it'll just aggravate Indiana fans, and I think that's hilarious. That's why I really want the Tom Crean statue, because I think it is the funniest thing in the world. Like, how nasty that relationship has sometimes gotten, and yet he's just stacking Big Ten titles on top of each other and cutting nets. I love it. It's my favorite story.
It's beautiful. Yeah, no, I agree with you, though, on Miami. I think that one thing that's also worth pointing out here is that Miami has done this against a considerably more difficult schedule than what North Carolina's faced this year. North Carolina has the easiest strength of schedule in the ACC, according to Ken Pom, and Miami's is middle of the pack, which is actually pretty good for a team at the top of the league. Like, if you look at like the high end of the ACC, you know, you have North Carolina, Virginia, Louisville, Duke, Notre Dame, and Syracuse. All of those teams are at least 9-8 in the league. None of those teams have a strength of schedule that's better than 10th in the league. They are the bottom 10 through 15 in the league in strength of schedule. And Miami has actually had to face a little bit more difficult of schedule than those guys, and they've still ended up picking up all of these wins in the process. It's a really remarkable job that Larrañaga has done there, not only in his 4 years, or I guess it's now 6 years since he's been there, but in this year particularly. I know that they have a really senior-oriented group, but this ACC is very difficult. Ooh. I mean, there are four top 10 teams right now in that league, according to KenPom, and they are included in that, and they will be a well-deserving ACC champion if it goes through.
Well, how about, just real quick, to put it in context, like, okay, and there's a lot of different ways to win league titles, but we can all agree, like, winning the ACC, I don't care how you do it, like, that's an amazing achievement. Like, Tony Bennett's won the past two at Virginia. I mean, this is a difficult league with Hall of Fame there are four active Hall of Fame coaches in the league, and they're all still operating at the same level. Like, you go win this league, you have done something. And not only is Larrañaga doing it at a school with basically no basketball history at all, he's done it with two completely different rosters. And he's done it without one-and-done stars. I mean, he has really just taken players that should not be achieving on this level and molded them into teams two different times. And when you combine it with what he's once upon a time did at George Mason, I mean, we are really talking about one of the great basketball coaches in this country.
All right. So a couple quick things for me here. One, the ACC tournament this year is going to be in Washington, D.C. So Larrañaga is going to practice with his team at George Mason's facility. I love that. And that is as pragmatic as it is superstitious, I'm sure, given this is the 10-year anniversary. He knows exactly what he's doing with that. It would be an amazing story if he did this with this Miami team 10 years removed, because you got to consider the programs that he would have. We are so long from this. But if he did do it, and this Miami team, by the way, can make the Final Four,
sure,
it's definitely good enough to do it. If that happened, I wouldn't hate it, because I would have read my Mason story the same year it happened, and that would be amazing timing.
You just retweet it every week.
But bada bang, right? But more than that, you could really, really start to make an argument that Larrañaga should get some Hall of Fame consideration if he's going to take those two programs. Again, he's got to do it, okay? But if he did it to take a Mason and Miami to the Final Four, and by the way, with Miami, I mean, we talked about a month ago, it's beyond anyone's expectation what he's done there, and it just speaks to how good of a coach he is. And I think a run, no matter what happens, like if Miami can reach another Sweet 16 minimally, I think this is the kind of run where people are going to start giving him his proper due, not as like, oh yeah, that fun-loving coach that took Mason to the Final Four, and start looking at him really as like a really high-level, fantastic coach at all levels.
Well, what do you think?
Can I just point out another thing about Miami too?
Sure.
Going forward, this is a team that isn't just built for this year. Like, they have a top 10 recruiting class coming in next year, featuring three kids that a lot of people really like, and DeJuan Huell, Bruce Brown up in, I want to say he's in like the Northeast, like Vermont or New Hampshire or something like that. And then they also have an Australian kid coming in, Dejan Vasiljevic, who has performed really well on all international stages. This is not going to be a like flash in the pan thing at Miami, where it's like a one in every 4 years thing. He really could get this going in a way that could have them at the top of the league, like Virginia has been consistently over the course of the last few years.
Because I think kids are starting to realize, hold up, you're telling me I can go play for a great coach in a building that's sold out in arguably the best league in the country and live in Miami?
Okay. And rap Ritz-Carlton in the locker room afterward?
Like, it really is. Like, what I go around to these college campuses, like I've been to all of the main basketball ones at some point. And like, with all due respect, I'm not going to single any of them out, but the ones that are like really, really cold. Like I go, why would you ever pick this place over like UCLA or over Miami? Like it's such a I know it hasn't historically been easy to recruit to Miami, but when you got it, when you got a nice facility, sold out, season tickets, you know, a guy who, you know, I don't think what Norlander said is absurd. It could be putting together a Hall of Fame resume, and the Miami weather. Like, why would you not want to go to college there? I don't think kids think enough about like what it's like to just walk around outside for a few years. Like, it's nice. Yeah, it's nice out there, man. That's where I'm going to school.
Can I also point out one other thing? If this like whole odds makers thing happens where North Carolina loses, Miami wins the outright title, that will be, I believe, 4 years in a row
that not Duke
either
or Carolina.
North Carolina or Duke has won the ACC, or even Louisville for that matter. It's pretty remarkable,
I wonder,
right?
But yeah,
well, it is because
Louisville just entered.
When was the last time there was a 4-year span in the ACC where neither Duke or Carolina won?
I bet you it's been a long, long time, because I looked this up a long time. Like for a while there, I mean, there was an exception every once in a while. Like Wake Forest would grab one or Maryland would grab one. But for a while, it was basically Duke or Carolina every year.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, yeah, we're on the verge of maybe going did you say it was 4 years? It'd be 4 years, because it would be Miami, Virginia, Miami. How about that? Who'd have ever thought that?
That's bonkers. But we'll see if it we'll see if it happens.
I will say this. In terms of North Carolina Duke, it sort of sits up like it did back in 2012 in this way. So Duke goes to North Carolina for the first of the two games, right? That's the Austin Rivers shot. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know exactly where I was for that one.
I know exactly where I was for that one too. Like I was in the building. I was in Chapel Hill. I was there at the game, and I was already writing about North Carolina winning. Like the game was over, and then Austin hits his crazy shot, and you start, you know, you scrap everything.
Was writing my last paper at Ohio State, like my one of my longest like theses at Ohio State, and. I like stood up on a chair and was like, holy crap.
Oh, no.
Like, it was unbelievable.
No, it was unbelievable, right? So then North Carolina is still in a position at the end to win the ACC, exactly like they are right. It's not exactly like they are right now, but in the same sense that they had a shot going into the final Duke game at Cameron to win the ACC title, even though they had already lost at home to Duke, and they beat the crap out of them. Like they beat them, I think they beat them.
That would have been Hansbrough's final Duke Carolina game.
I don't remember that. I don't know.
Yeah, because no. What am I thinking?
It wasn't even close to that.
He was done in 2010.
Yeah, they beat them like bad. They went into Cameron final Saturday night of regular season and just beat them bad. So whereas you wouldn't typically pick against Duke and Cameron, and I don't think I'm picking against Duke and Cameron this weekend. You know, Roy's got something to pull from. You know, he can like say, hey, we were in the same spot 2012. They beat us in our building in a game that we weren't supposed to lose. We still had an opportunity to win the ACC, and we went in their building and we ran them off their own court. Let's go run them off their own court again. I don't know if it'll work, but we've seen that scenario play out before. That's my point.
Okay, fair enough. Can we hit on the Arch Madness real quick here?
I am going to Arch Madness tomorrow, Norlander. We can talk about it all you want to.
Okay, so here's my thing. Okay, here's my guess. Let's say Wichita State loses in the semis, doesn't even get to the finals. Okay. I wonder. This will be an interesting litmus test this year. Do you realize that Wichita State is 8th in KenPom right now?
Yes, because I look at it every single day.
Okay, so let's say if it loses in the semis, worst case scenario. I would think it's 15 for Wichita State. Worst. It probably won't even fall that far. I wonder if Wichita State is basically going to get in no matter what.
I'll tell you this.
Because of that number. Because if the committee's going to be looking at KenPom stuff more and more, and if we've reached a point where we can agree that if you're a top 15 KenPom team, you're a team that deserves to be in the NCAA tournament, broadly speaking, I think that's a practical and reasonable thing to say.
I would go as far as top 30 even. But
I know, but I know that's
but
not
here's what reasonable. I would say. Here's what I would say. If you look at their wins and losses, that is not a tournament resume.
Well, listen,
I'm not going to argue against Wichita State. I love them so much, and I want them in the NCAA tournament. But when you look at what they've actually done this year, it is not a tournament resume.
Okay. I'm not saying necessarily that it is or it isn't. I'm saying I would be very interested to see what would happen to them if they didn't even make the tournament final and if they would still get in just because of how highly rated they are by those metrics. But having said all of that, I think they are going to roll to the championship because I think
they know that they know
and they got it. They know they got to get it. They know they got to get it. And honestly, like, there aren't many dudes in college basketball who like truly like back against the wall. Like I'd pick over Van Vliet. I just think he's a mother when it comes to that kind of stuff. And I'm expecting him to have a pretty big weekend.
They have one top 85 win. One. They beat Utah. Okay.
That's yeah, I forget everything I said then.
No, they have one. They like I'm. Listen.
No, I'm saying like that's brutal if that's the case.
They've won. The next best win they got is an Evansville win. Evansville.
Yeah, I don't think Palm has them. I don't think Palm gives them any chance. By the way, for an at large, I would give them a chance, but.
Well, here's the crazy thing: like we've counted out Gonzaga, like for a while now, as far as getting an at large.
I know.
Like they have a almost considerably better resume. Than Wichita State.
There's nothing there. I love Wichita State so much. But there is nothing on that resume that says put them in the tournament if they don't get the automatic bid.
Yeah, like Wichita State is – or Gonzaga has three top 70 wins, no losses outside of the top 60.
Right. No. So – yeah, Wichita's got one top 85 win. They've got
– yeah, granted, it's a really nice win, but it's a home win.
Yeah, they've got – okay, they've got three losses outside of the top 50, one outside of the top 100. And here's the thing. If they don't get the automatic bid, it means they got to take another loss. And if they take another loss, guess what it is? Another loss outside of the top 50. So if they don't get the automatic bid, here's where they're sitting at. Because they're going to have only one top 85 win no matter what. Because nobody else in the Missouri Valley is in the top 85 of the RPI. So they're gonna be on Selection Sunday with one top 85 win no matter what. And if they don't get the automatic bid, it means they're taking another sub 50 loss. I'll tell you this. If you change their name from Wichita to Illinois State, we wouldn't even be talking about them at all.
Well, agreed, unless Illinois State had the same exact deal and was eighth in
Kempom. I bet you in the history of this podcast, heading into the final week of the regular season, into March Madness, into this weekend, we have never discussed whether a team with one top 85 win and three losses outside of the top 50 should get in the tournament, ever in the history of any podcast. I'll stretch it out. Any podcast.
Including your
music podcast.
I will be interested to see if Wichita State does lose, how it's handled with that, but I don't think it will lose.
How about Greg Marshall not winning Missouri Valley Conference Coach of the Year?
Did that happen? Who won it?
Barry Hinson, the homie Barry Hinson.
Well,
I actually agree with that.
Are you out of your mind? And I love Barry Hinson, but the idea that you could win your league by four games and not be the coach of the year is crazy.
Yeah, that might be fair.
And you know why? Here's why.
Hinson didn't. They didn't close the year well either.
No, listen. I I'm actually writing. I'm actually writing. This is going to be the final thought in my Inside College Hoops column for Friday. But so I'm not going to protest it because I really like Barry Hinson. I think he's a good man and a good coach. And he was up against it this year. I don't think he was on the hot seat list just because people don't care about what's going on at Southern Illinois. But he was in a tough spot. You know, he had people transfer out of the program and people were questioning whether he could do the job. And he broke through a little bit this year. And, you know, I was there for the Wichita State game. They got run off the court, but it was a wonderful environment, sold out. I was happy to see him have this season. So I'm not going to protest, but it is insane that Greg Marshall's not the Missouri Valley Conference Coach of the Year. But it's a part of a
league. I mean, he's the clear best coach in the league.
Nobody
doubts that.
You know what? But here's what happens, and this never makes sense to me. Men who run a top shelf program get it held against them when it comes to getting awards. Because just being the best program in the Missouri Valley Conference, because you created it and putting together a roster and developing players in a way that makes you the clear favorite, shouldn't be a negative for you.
Okay, here's going to be my question for you. In the Big 12, who do you think is the coach of the year?
Bill Self!
Is it Bill Self or your boy Tubby?
No, it's Bill Self and it ain't close. If you win the Big 12 again with zero first round draft picks in your starting lineup, the toughest league in the country, we all call it. And here he is again, going to win it by multiple games, for the 12th straight year. It's Bill Self, but Bill Self will have it held against him, and people will vote for Tubby because Tubby overachieved. I think you got to look at the big picture when it comes to conference coach of the years. Don't just tell me, because what it tends to be is what coach overachieved more than anybody else. Let's give it to him. And here's the best proof of this. By the end of the 2007 college basketball season, you ready for this? It's going to blow your mind. It might not blow your mind, but it's interesting. By the end of the 2007 college basketball season, Billy Donovan had 3 SEC regular season championships, 4 SEC tournament championships, 3 Final Four appearances, and 2 national championships, and 0 SEC Coach of the Year awards. He never won an SEC Coach of the Year. He had 2 national championships before he ever won an SEC Coach of the Year award. In 2006, John Brady won it. In 2007, Kevin Stallings won it. The idea that a guy could win 3 SEC regular season titles, 4 SEC tournament titles, go to 3 Final Fours and win 2 national titles, and at that moment have 2 national championship rings and 0 SEC Coach of the Year award honors? Like, it's insane, but that's the way people vote on it. But it's
okay,
wrong.
So here would be my reason why I would vote for Tubby.
Go ahead.
You're probably going to call me stupid.
Yeah, or dumb. So, stupid or dumb.
You know, I picked Kansas to win the national title this year. Like, I understand what your point is going to be. But at a certain point, like, do we reward Coach of the Year for best recruiter? Like, should we reward that award for being the best at recruiting talent to your team?
Gary's stance is that should be accounting for 50% of the award. Your ability to actually recruit and get players should go toward consideration for
would you
consider it is a major part of the job.
No, and that's fine with me. I think that's a fair way to award the award.
Sam, you're an athletic director. You're going to hire a coach. Do you consider recruiting at all, his ability to do it?
Yes.
Of course. It's part of the job. It's probably the biggest part of the job. And for that not to be factored into the Coach of the Year award seems crazy to me. I'll just rely on the fact that Billy Donovan had 2 national titles but before he had an SEC Coach of the Year trophy. As long as we can all agree that's ridiculous, then we can.
I mean, what are we even talking about here?
Then what are we even talking about here?
Hey, Bill Self does have 1 WAC Coach of the Year before he won that national title.
This is going to be my new soapbox. Once Sean Miller and I shut down these court stormings, my next thing I'm going to turn my attention to is making sure people understand how to vote for League Coach of the Year. Because you can't just give it to the dude that overachieves as much. Greg Marshall should be the Missouri Valley Conference Coach of the Year. You know who should be the Mountain West Coach of the Year? Steve Fisher. You know who should win the Big 12 Coach of the Year?
Well, now you're just currying favor with San Diego State fans.
I'm pretty sure they're over all that. the Big East Coach of the Year? Maybe Chris Mack. But like
Chris Mack.
I would at least listen to that. All right, that's fine. I could at least listen to that.
Who would be your ACC Coach of the Year?
I'd probably lead Larinaga.
Larinaga, yeah.
Okay, I would take Coach K because I think that to keep that team together by like a shoestring, basically, was more impressive than what Larinaga did.
There's something to that. This is a total guess.
Let me pause for a second. I want to remind you that Jim Larinaga at Miami is about to win an outright ACC title, probably.
Yes.
Oh, no, we just spent like however long talking about that, but I think that Coach K keeping basically a 5.5 man team together.
Let me say this in all seriousness. I think it's dumb to vote for Tubby Smith as much as I think what Tubby's doing there is great. I do not think it's dumb to vote for Mike Krzyzewski. That's not crazy.
Yeah. And I wonder how many, like Krzyzewski, I could be way off and completely wrong on this, but I almost feel like Krzyzewski might have this Phil Jackson thing going. Like, didn't Phil like only win Coach of the Year twice or something in the NBA? Maybe I don't even have that right, but I feel like Krzyzewski doesn't even have that many Coach of the Years in the ACC, and yet he's, you know, arguably the greatest coach of all time.
You know what? We don't give it's the craziest thing. We don't.
Coach K has won the Naismith Coach of the Year award 3 times. He's won ACC Coach of the Year 5 times.
We don't, but like
okay, 5 times in 30 years.
That's crazy.
5 years.
How many years has he actually been at Duke?
He's been at Duke since 80. 80.
Yeah,
you're telling me he was
36th year.
He was only the Coach of the Year in the ACC 5 of those times.
Yeah,
get out of my face. It's stupid. People don't know how to vote for coaches. The idea that the best coaches in the leagues don't win Coach of the Year awards is like insane.
Yeah.
I wonder if this whole idea is like, trickle down from the NBA where like it's a separation of power. There's an executive of the year and a coach of the year in the NBA. And I wonder if like there's a trickle down in the way people vote for college coach of the year and just consider coaching. It's just, like, I wonder if there should be a recruiter of the year award and a coach of the year award.
I know there should just be a coach of the year. And here's how you should figure it out. Here's how you should vote. You should look at the league and you should go, who's done the best job? Who's done the best job to get to where they're at right now? That's the way you should vote for coach of the year. You look at the Big 12, you look at the Missouri Valley Conference, and you say, who has done the best job to get to where they're at this moment? And again, I love Barry Hinson so much. Barry, if you listen to this, understand I love you to pieces.
No shot, Barry Hinson.
Shout out to Barry Hinson. He might. He might be. You don't know that, Norlander. You can't know that for sure. But like, Greg Marshall just won the Missouri Valley Conference by 4 games. Like, he's built a program where he can run away with a league that has historically been competitive. That's your coach of the year. What are we talking about? What are we even talking about?
And we're going to vote for John Calipari for coach of the year.
I think probably so. Shouldn't we? Loses.
A&M is the one seed right now.
Well, think about this. Everybody's going to like spin it a whole bunch of ways and say he's the most, but he's got all the best players, blah, blah, blah. Lose 7 dudes off a team and win an SEC title the next season. Because that's what's about to happen.
Has he done appreciably better than what we expected with this talent level?
He ripped. He had 7 players ripped off his team last season, and he's still about to get another SEC championship. That's good.
No, it's definitely good. Don't get me wrong. I wonder if there is an argument for someone else.
If your point is that...
Like, he's kind of scuffled with his front court the whole year. Like, he hasn't figured out a way to get those guys together.
You kidding me? Did you not watch Kentucky the other night? Scow has figured it out.
Where'd that game happen?
Scow's figured it out.
Where was that game?
It only took 4 months.
Did you stop watching, Sam? Have you stopped watching college basketball this season? Because Scow figured it out. It's over with now.
I so badly wanted to work in a little Gary thing like Trump did little Marco, but I forgot to do it. Dude. Little Gary.
We said
we'd have this podcast be 25 minutes. We've gone double that.
Little Mark, because you couldn't stop bragging about your Mason story.
I was so giddy.
Dude, the Trump Little Marco thing makes me laugh so hard. He looks at him and says, Little Marco. It is so funny to me. That is a grown man talking to another grown man. It's the most ridiculous thing in the world. Like, that Republican presidential debate is the most ridiculous. Like, it really, if you didn't know any, like, if you came from a different time, you would think it's a Saturday Night Live skit. It is, like, it is a Saturday Night Live skit. Like, Tina Fey could have authored that.
It's ridiculous.
And I know people, like, some of my friends, like, when I'm laughing at it, they're like, well, how could you laugh? This is depressing state of affairs in our country. And I'm like, listen, I gave up on trying to change the world. All I do is rank basketball teams. All right. Like, I ain't changing the world. I'm going to be amazed by the world. And the idea that this dude up there is running away with the Republican nomination and calling and bragging about his penis, by the way. All right. I forgot about that. How did I forget about that? Like, the idea that this is happening, that this is real life. I love it. There's a very twisted part of me that just wants to see this thing go as long as it could go, because it is wildly entertaining. Also depressing on some level, I acknowledge that, but it is also amazing. I love the debate so much. I can barely watch Arizona Cal because I can't stop watching the debate. I probably missed about 9 of Jaylen Brown's fouls.
So what's our plan for Monday's podcast then?
I don't know. Let's talk about that for a second. Monday is what? Monday is where will I be? Oh, I'll be home.
You will be home this time. Yeah, I don't so we go can to, actually I don't, do like a Monday morning
we podcast. We can actually do a Monday morning podcast because I don't go back to I'm in St. Louis this weekend for Arch Madness. Looking forward to that. It's a great event. Hope to see everybody there. I just want to see everybody.
I promised Seth Davis a shout out on the spot.
Shout out to Seth Davis. He's the best. I tell you, I can't tell you for certain that Barry Hinson's listening right now.
We know Seth is listening.
Seth Davis is the most loyal listener we got. We should bring him on sometime. Just let him shout out some things.
I think we should.
That's true.
Okay. So shout out to Seth Davis for sure. So I'm going to Arch Madness and I'm going to be the sideline reporter for the semifinals. But then they're bringing in Allie LaForce for the championship game.
You're getting pulled.
Can you imagine how depressing it is for those coaches that lose in the semifinals, have to talk to me, never get a chance to kick it with Allie? I feel bad for them. So I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to come home Sunday, and then I'll be actually home for a few days. I go to New York, I think, again, maybe Wednesday or so for championship week. But I'll certainly be home on Monday. We're going to talk Monday morning.
We'll make it happen, man.
Okay, guys. Come on. Probably going to be more like Monday afternoon for you guys.
Why for me? What do you think? You're the one on the West Coast. Norlander.
It's going to be Monday morning for me, but yeah, for you guys, well, Norlander, it's going to be like 12:30.
Hey, I'm up at 5:50 every morning. So anytime you guys want to do a 5:50 in the morning podcast, I'm down with it. I can go ahead and knock it out, get it done for the
that
day.
That thing will really go off the rails. Really bad.
There would be no rails.
I hate getting up at 5:50 in the morning so much.
Drive safe, GP.
I'm gonna drive safely. Everything's gonna be cool, and then we will talk again on Monday morning. Actually, Monday morning, certainly Monday morning, on the Pacific Coast, right?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe Sunday night. Might want to go Sunday night.
Hey, we'll figure this out in a text message, like a group message or something. Shout out to Seth Davis. Shout out to Barry Hinson. I appreciate both of you listening. If you want to subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast, go do that at iTunes. Best way to get your hands on the latest episodes as quickly as possible. And we will talk to you at some point late Sunday or early Monday. We'll figure it out. We don't have to commit to that later.